Good afternoon, and welcome to the 12th and last meeting of our 2008-2009 season. Just a reminder, please silence your cell phones. And now, the Reverend Bruce Antle, Senior Pastor at the North Naples United Methodist Church, will deliver the invocation.
Well, if you don't tell Dr. Sauter, for those of you who know Dr. Sauter from North Naples United Methodist Church, that he's no longer senior pastor, and that I have now been promoted, I won't tell him either. I'm actually the executive pastor at North Naples, and about 2 hours ago, Dr. Sauter gave me a call, and he said, "Bruce, can you help me out?" He said, "My knee went out, and I can barely walk." I thought everybody possibly here, except maybe for some of our young people, which what a thrill to have our young people here, could identify with that. And when he called me, I happened to be in a devotional that a gentleman was relating his lawnmower to his relationship with God. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And what he was doing was he was trying to start his lawnmower, pulling and pulling and pulling and pulling. He checked to make sure that his gasoline was there. It had gasoline, it had oil, it had a new spark plug, but it wouldn't start until he discovered in the gas tank his children had put pebbles, and it was preventing the fuel, of course, to get to the spark plug. And he thought, isn't that interesting how so many of us can look good, have all the right things in place, our spark plug in place and our fuel tank filled, but pebbles in our life preventing us to connect with the divine. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we give you thanks for a new day that you've given us and for each and every one that's here this day, not only to participate in a luncheon and to hear a wonderful speaker and a message today, but also for the young people that are here, that as they are beginning their there are many of them, not only college, but also their future endeavors. Lord, we ask your blessings on them and blessings on this food. Amen.
You know, this has been a great year. We've had 12 exceptional speakers. I'm already assuming that today's speaker will be exceptional too. And I want to recognize those who made it possible. Please hold your applause until all are standing. The retiring directors who've been so valuable, Karna Bodman, Joe Fogg, Dick Splittorff, Roy White, and unable to attend were Catherine Eichhoff-Smith and Ralph Larson. The 2008 and 2009 officers, Tom Bryngardner, Malcolm Chancey, Bumpy Fraser, Wade Keller, Ulla Norris, Linda Utnod, and incidentally, Linda is our hospitality chair. And then, finally, but certainly not least, the program committee from last year, which arranged for this year's program. All of the members of the program committee from last year, please stand, and now you can honor them all. I'd like to make a special introduction because we do have many students here today. I want to introduce the superintendent of schools from Collier County, Dr. Dennis Thompson. Thank you for coming as a guest of the club, Dennis. And now, an annual treat that we never give up. One of our founding directors, a past president of the club, the former president and publisher of the Naples Daily News, will talk about our scholarship, our longtime scholarship program called the Gentry Award, Corbin Wyant.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, for the first year this year, we are combining the scholarship awards and the Gentry Awards, The new award will be called the Forum Members Gentry Award, given in honor of Bill Gentry, who was our founder and our first executive director. Just a few words about Bill. Bill was a journalist who spent his entire journalism career on Marco Island, first as editor of the Marco Eagle and finally as the bureau chief of the Naples Daily News. He had a dream of establishing this organization based on the model of the Economic Club of Detroit and the Forum Club of Palm Beaches. And in 1985, at age 64, on his retirement from the Naples Daily News, he put the dream into action. He recruited a board of directors. There are still two of us here. The other is Alan Correst. Alan, raise your hand. We, in turn, recruited all of our friends. The Daily News publicized the formation of the club, and we very quickly filled our ranks and were able early on to establish this wonderful waiting list. In 1988, Bill, if that was the year I was president, Bill proposed the student guest concept, and that has been a very important part of our program and activity ever since. On his death in 1992, the directors established the Gentry Award, and we're pleased to have that presented today and congratulate the student recipients. Thank you.
Now, Roy White, who is the chairman of our education committee, which has teams of people out interviewing the scores and scores of applicants for these awards, will now read the names of the recipients, and when your name is called, please stand and hold your applause until he finishes, please.
This is the reward that you've heard me mention many, many times this year. Community School, Mary Kate Murphy. Please stand, Mary. Rebecca Stern. Everglades City School, Carissa Brown. Renee Gonzalez. Golden Gate High School, Megan Houlihan and Laura Santa Maria. Gulf Coast High School, Noel Hom, Morgan Papworth, and Andrea Ramos. Homeschooled, Ashayla Pazerati and Judith Stewart. Immokalee High School, Andrea Alaya, Martin Lopez, and Sergio Martinez. Lely High School, Elta Desvoristas, Ashley Forrest, Greta Schneider-Hare, Daniel Ventilla. Naples High School, Ainsley Brown, Daniel Evans, Alicia Finger. Pace, Yeseni. Palmetto Ridge High School, Justin Berker, Machia Lalo, Kimberly Mine. St. John Newman High School, Sarah Lynch, Robert McGinnis. Now I know you'll all want to join me in an enthusiastic applause.
Each of these students will receive a $1,000 scholarship from the club and from your generosity. And now enjoy your lunch, and we will be back in about 20 minutes. May I have your attention, please? A couple of reminders. Remember, there are question cards at your tables. Please write down your questions as fast as you can so that the hospitality committee can gather them during the speech so that we can ask them of the speaker when he finishes. Also, after the program today, there will be a little bit of extra program. So please stay for a couple of minutes once the speaker and the questions are concluded. And now Dick Bodman, one of our great members, will introduce our speaker today.
Thank you, Mr. President, and good afternoon, everybody. I'll bet you thought you were here to listen to one of my better-known relatives today. I have to tell you that it hasn't quite worked out that way yet, but it will. Today's speaker is a fellow that I have known for exactly half of my life. And I can honestly say, if I'd known him for all of my life, I'd be a better person for it. He is an incredible human being. I'm going to borrow a little bit from comments that we heard made at a birthday party that was given for him in Washington not too long ago. And the comments were made by friends and family, but two seem to me somewhat the essential characteristics of this man. First, he is a man of principle. You're not dealing with a person who won't tell you what he really thinks. You're not dealing with a person that changes his mind just because it's popular. You're dealing with a man who has studied things, thinks about things, has a sensible attitude. And when he gets his mind made up, you deal with it straightforward. The second thing about him is really quite remarkable, was well said by his daughter, who was describing what his father said to her on her way to college, which went something like this: "And tomorrow is another day to prove that you can be better." And that's what Sam's all about. Every single day of his life, in every activity that I've known that he's been involved in. And I'm not going to repeat to you what you've seen in that wonderful resume in there, but I do want to make an important point. This is a man who has reached some rather fancy heights in the academic world, in the business world, and in the government world. In the academic world, as a student, he was a good one, all the way through to the doctorate level, and ended up for many years involved in the MIT Corporation Board and a number of other activities affecting that great university. And then he got involved into business, which he took on with the same approach. One of the parts that he and I shared at different times was the venture capital world, where this man was one of the earliest pioneers in the business, working for probably the greatest pioneer in the business way back at a company called American Research and Development. As you know, he went on to head the Fidelity Investment Company and later the Cabot Corporation. But then he went into government, something that was a total surprise to me. When I had gone into the government years ago, Sam kind of looked at me as a strange duck, and I was a strange duck, but I didn't think that was what he would end up doing. But he went in, and he's held three positions over the 7 or so years that he was in the government, all at the very highest levels. Two as Deputy Secretary of Commerce, and then Treasury, and then Secretary of Energy, which is basically the focus of what he's going to talk about today. All of those are wonderful things for somebody to do. They're nice positions to hold. But I want to say, I've lived around Washington long enough to know that it is a very rare event when somebody can come in from either academia or industry, much less both, and be effective in the environment in Washington, which is totally different from the structure of how industry works in this country, and be effective. And he was not only effective. I've checked with my friends around the town, and here's a fellow who has been respected from the beginning by people on both sides of the aisle in that city. And that is a very rare thing. So you're about to hear a fellow who really has done quite a job in his short time in government. Lastly, just to say how serious he is about delivering against his promises, he accepted the high reward that we offer him, nothing, for coming down here to speak. And I want to say that he can honestly say, I was just almost dying to come down to speak to the forum, because Wednesday night he was having dinner with a good friend and his wife in a fancy restaurant in Washington, and he ate some tuna tartare, God knows why. And that just about did him in. They called yesterday to say, this man is very, very ill, and we're not so sure, but he thinks he's going to make it. And by God, he did. And bless you for making it. So I want to ask you to thank this man for showing that he really means to do business.
Thank you, sir. There you go. Thank you, Dick, for that nice introduction. I also want to thank Alan, as well as the board members, for having me here today. I also understand that we have some students here today, and I want to welcome them here. And now I have to tell you that I know where all the tough questions will come from. It is a pleasure to be back in Florida. My wife Diana and I spend quite a bit of time here, although not as much as we would like. As you may know, I have not done any speaking engagements since leaving my post as Energy Secretary, but it was important for me to be here today. This forum has a long history of bringing together civic and business leaders from throughout Southwest Florida to discuss the leading issues of the day. And I feel privileged to join the list of distinguished speakers who have addressed this group. I trust it will come as no surprise to anyone in this room that, in my view, our world faces enormous energy challenges today. They include growing global demand for all types of energy, volatile prices, and an urgent need to produce and use energy in ways that reduce greenhouse gas emissions and do not harm our shared environment or our security. Worldwide energy demand is projected to grow by over 45% by the year 2030, 20 plus years from now. And that's even taking into account our current global economic problems. The International Energy Agency estimates that this increase in global demand will necessitate at least $26 trillion in new investment over that period, about $1 trillion a year. At the same time, we have clear challenges on the environmental front. In my judgment, climate change is a serious problem that demands our attention and sustained action. This is our dual challenge, to meet growing global demand in a way that recognizes the reality of climate change and does not harm our collective environment. This challenge seems daunting, and particularly so in light of our current global financial crisis and the many vital demands on our government resources. And I certainly don't intend to suggest that governments alone will bear this cost. The private sector, rightly, has a major role to play and a major investment opportunity here, especially if it is supported with the right policy environment. But I mention all this to provide a sense of the scope of the challenge that we all face, and to underscore a key point, which I believe many of you will agree with. Today, we cannot afford to separate out the discussions of our energy challenges and our environmental ones. And though no one knows precisely what the future holds, we do know this. We absolutely must continue on a path to a more secure, cleaner, more sustainable, and more affordable energy future for all Americans, indeed for all citizens of the world. So what does that mean? Well, personally, I believe that we must continue to pursue a broad national energy agenda, the major components of which include the following. First, dramatically improved energy efficiency in all sectors of our economy. Second, a continued aggressive move to renewable energy and alternative fuel, especially advanced biofuels. Thirdly, more efficient and environmentally sustainable use of fossil fuels, including clean coal. And fourthly, advanced nuclear power. I'm very proud of the work that we did during the Bush administration in all of these areas and others as well. But let me just mention a few things in particular which I hope will continue to be supported or even accelerated by the current administration. First and nearest to my heart, throughout my time as Energy Secretary, we worked to elevate the role of science, both through the national laboratories, which, after all, are part of the Energy Department, and in conjunction with research universities across this country. Our goal was and must continue to be to achieve the truly transformational discoveries that our nation requires to materially improve our energy security. In particular, I would point to our work to establish 3 bioenergy centers in Tennessee, in Wisconsin, and in California. These consortia were selected from over 30 applicants and were funded for 5 years to the tune of $25 million a year per center. These multidisciplinary centers are already performing cutting-edge basic research to advance the optimization of biomass energy feed sources and develop innovative approaches for converting them into renewable fuels to replace gasoline. This is way beyond corn-based ethanol, folks. These are next-generation, more efficient biofuels that do not use food crops. Instead, they convert biomass, like agricultural residues, grasses, poplar trees, inedible plants, and non-edible portions of crops, directly to sugars, and then convert, using catalytic means, directly into alkanes and aromatics and other fuel components. In other words, they take biomass ingredients and through sugar create real gasoline, not ethanol. In my view, they represent the most significant component of an ongoing national effort to break our reliance on fossil fuels. And I am pleased that, at least based on what we know so far, the Obama administration and Energy Secretary Chu appear to be continuing the focus on science, both basic and applied. The stimulus bill contained provisions for the national laboratories, among other things. In general, I see more attention to basic science as a net positive. However, the answer does not lie simply in more money, which is a problem that Washington has. How we spend it and what we spend it on is just as important, if not more so. We must pursue a diverse mix of clean energy solutions if we are to truly change the global energy equation. To that point, we did a significant amount of work over the past several years to help usher in the new era for nuclear power in this country. Through the Energy Department's advanced research programs, loan guarantee programs, federal risk insurance, as well as the submission of the license application for Yucca Mountain, for the Yucca Mountain facility, we kept our focus on one goal: getting new nuclear power plants built in a way that responsibly manages spent fuel and reduces the threat of proliferation. And we saw real signs of progress. We had 17 applications for combined operating licenses for for up to 26 new nuclear power plants filed with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the last year of the Bush administration, in 1 year. Frankly, that was something that went largely unnoticed, but after 30 years without any such progress, I believed that it was very important. I hope this work continues at a rapid pace. Government involvement is perhaps even more crucial now, given the financial crisis that we're facing, which is certainly felt in the nuclear industry. I would also add this. It is very clear that civilian nuclear power expansion will occur around the world. Indeed, it is happening now. Recognizing this reality, the United States developed the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, or GNEP as we called it, to shape the world's nuclear energy future in a way that not only benefits our economy and our environment, but improves our security by reducing the risk of proliferation. With 25 member nations at present, this is an unprecedented initiative and a testament to the urgency of our world's challenges as well as our opportunities. I mention this focus on nuclear power for two reasons. First, the Energy Department has fundamental responsibilities in this area, not only in terms of advanced nuclear energy research and dealing with the waste, but also in terms of ensuring the security and the reliability of our nuclear weapons stockpile and working to prevent nuclear proliferation around the world. And secondly, I believe that nuclear energy is and must remain a major piece of our national effort to produce cleaner energy. At present, nuclear power is the only mature technology that can supply very large amounts of emissions-free base load power. Certainly, there are other technologies available or under development: wind power, solar energy, biomass, as well as clean coal and sequestration technologies that are making a difference, and increasingly so. But if we are talking about what is available to order right now and would have a major impact on our ability to produce homegrown, clean power, in my view, we simply must talk about nuclear power. To be sure, there are challenges to bringing more nuclear power online. There are technical, regulatory, and financial issues, and they are not to be underestimated. We also must deal with spent fuel and high-level radioactive waste on a permanent basis, while at the same time pursuing new technologies for recycling spent fuel. These technologies, which have the potential to significantly reduce the volume, the thermal output, and the radiotoxicity of the waste requiring permanent geological disposal. On the subject of storage, let me be clear. For literally decades, the Yucca Mountain facility in Nevada has been a hostage of the political process. In some ways, it may even be worse now. But let's not forget, currently nuclear waste is stored at about 120 temporary locations in 39 states. We need a solution. I believe we have a responsibility to future generations, to the young people in this room, to deal with this waste problem on a permanent, not a temporary basis. So my question is, if not at Yucca Mountain, then where and when? At the same time that we continue to expand nuclear power and aggressively pursue renewable power and alternative fuels, we also must continue to make coal-fired plants cleaner and more efficient. This includes finding ways to capture and store CO2 emissions and deploying those solutions as widely and cost-effectively as possible. Clean coal is a necessity for the United States, where we depend on our native coal resources for electricity generation. But it is an absolute imperative for much of the rest of the world, including China and India. As the International Energy Agency has reported, worldwide demand for coal has been growing faster than any other energy source in recent years, and it is projected to account for more than a third of incremental global energy demand by the year 2030, with China leading the way. We need technologies that will increase the efficiency of these coal-fired plants and make them cleaner, and we need them now. The development of a completely emissions-free coal-fired plant is sort of the holy grail, if you will, of the clean coal world, and it is an undeniably worthwhile goal. But achieving such a plant or demonstrating it through a multi-million dollar earmark, as the United States Congress appears set on doing, takes us only so far. We also need to deal with the existing plants and the new ones coming online around the world every day. The truth is, even modest increases in efficiency for existing plants would result in major improvements and emissions reductions when taken globally. The point is, folks, we need to do it all. All types of renewable energy and advanced biofuels, clean coal and sustainable development of oil and gas, advanced nuclear power, and major improvements in the efficiency of our vehicles, our homes, our offices, our industries, and our utilities. And I'm very encouraged by that many Republicans and Democrats alike acknowledge the importance of all this work and the urgency with which it must continue, as do most Americans, regardless of our political affiliations. Americans recognize that going forward, our energy and climate challenges are our shared responsibility and our shared opportunity. I'm very optimistic that we will embrace them, but doing so will continue to demand sustained action from all of us. And so while I continue to believe that government has a crucial role to play in addressing our energy challenges, and I believe that view is shared by the current administration, let me also state the obvious. Government simply can't do this by itself. The broader economic climate is the major driver here, including such factors as global recovery and economic growth, energy prices, and the availability of financing. Let me give you an example. As oil prices rose during 2008, the amount of venture capital going into what is known as the clean tech area, which includes alternative energy and efficiency technologies, it grew dramatically, 08 compared to 07. In 08, we saw a 52% increase in venture capital investment in the clean tech sector. But even in the midst of this generally positive trend, in the fourth quarter of 08, the broader economic conditions overwhelmed everything else, and there was a drop in clean tech, specifically a 14% decline from the third quarter to the fourth quarter. The point is, government funding alone will not be enough to achieve a new energy future, though it is an essential and, in my view, it's a mistake to downplay it. But economic recovery is as important a driver. This is particularly true with regard to the financing of large-scale energy projects. This brings me to another role of the federal government, market stability. Part of my job as the Energy Secretary involved meeting with our partners around the world. That is to say, I was an occasional diplomat, although not always a willing one. And in that role, I often discussed with foreign leaders the need for stable investment climates and transparency. And let's face it, it is bad in many places around the world. But it is also true that we can do a lot better here at home. One example is what is called the Production Tax Credit, a mechanism whereby producers of energy from renewable sources like wind, geothermal, or biomass receive tax incentives for the first 10 years of a facility's operation. The credit was originally passed in 1992, believe it or not, and it has been renewed 6 times. It has expired a few times, and it has been retroactively reinstated. And every time, Congress picks some amount of money that it is willing to spend, and this determines how much longer the credit will be extended. Indeed, the production tax credit has appeared most recently in the stimulus bill, which extended it for another 3 years. The stimulus package also changed the program somewhat, adding the option for receiving an investment tax credit instead, or even taking the benefit as an upfront grant for the amount of the credit. While this extension and the program changes will likely to be productive in the short term, in my view, this is no way to provide a stable marketplace over the years. Is the permanent tax credit there, or is it not? Will we extend the credit for some number of years and then decrease it over time at a known rate? These are very long-term investment decisions being made by the private sector, and so the policy environment should allow some higher degree of certainty and stability. Similarly, we have too much uncertainty today around the question of how we are going to regulate carbon dioxide. It practically goes without saying that this is a fantastically complicated and expensive issue. And I don't think anyone has any illusions about it, including the President Obama. The President has expressed support for a cap and trade system. Then the Senate Majority Leader has said that he wants debate on a climate bill by the end of the summer, although that now seems less certain by my own reading. As with everything, the details are critical, and so far we just don't know. But personally, I believe that it is more important to get something done than to just continue our current state. Action, whatever it is, and it may be nothing, although I tend to doubt that, will lead us toward a more certain regulatory environment for carbon. We need a framework so that businesses know the rules, and I hope to see movement towards certainty, whatever that is, very soon. When it comes to cap and trade and other complex energy issues, the federal government is uniquely positioned to bring together all parties, the private sector, academia, state governments, regulatory agencies, and consumer groups to tackle our most pervasive challenges and to develop a roadmap for working through them. This is also true with regard to our electric grid. The time has come to really examine on a national or perhaps a regional scale how we are going to modernize our grid, how we are going to add capacity for new renewable projects, including possibly through an extra high voltage or an EHV system, who is going to pay for it, and how will the new lines be sited and constructed. I'm proud that we started this conversation and began to push the ball forward, uphill to be sure, but as our energy infrastructure continues to age and is pushed to its limits, this is perhaps one of the most significant challenges that we will face. And it is a discussion that must continue to be led at the federal level with all interested parties engaged. And I believe that it will be. I remain very optimistic about our nation's ability to deal with these challenges successfully. My career in the private sector as well as in government has taught me to never underestimate the great power of the American people and our economy, even in tough times. Indeed, throughout our nation's history, the strength and vibrancy of our economy has been rooted in America's ability to innovate, in our commitment to discover, to create, and to change. Whether we are in government, the private sector, academia, or just as private citizens, we all share a fundamental responsibility to discover, to deploy, and support the solutions to power and secure America's energy future. And I believe that we are well on our way to doing that, although we are not there yet. The road to our new energy reality is long and it is littered with obstacles, but I believe it is within our sight. These solutions are coming into focus, and in some cases are already moving from the laboratory to commercial markets at remarkable speed. The work before us as a nation is very real and is very substantial. It is difficult, but in my judgment, it is achievable. And the results will continue to benefit all Americans and all citizens of the world. I want to thank you very much for the chance to be here with you today. I'm very happy to take your questions.
Mr. Secretary, that was a tremendous talk that gave us an awful lot of meat to chew on, and I'm sure you're going to get to chew on some more in just a second. But before that happens, we want you to come back many, many times. We have a book here about Marco Island's culture and history and another one about Naples. We know you know something about it already, but we hope you enjoy it. I'll take these back to your seat.
Thank you very much.
And now Dick is going to unload on you with the audience's questions.
All right.
He needed helpers to sort through the mountain of questions.
Thank you, sir.
Sam, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
The fun is just beginning. I won't do this to every student, but I'm going to announce that the first question is from a student.
They're the worst one.
It's on point. How do you feel about Obama's recent decision to release chemicals in the air to affect global warming?
I truly don't know about what his decision is. I frankly haven't worried about it. When I walked out of there, I walked. This is chemicals in the air to reduce global warming?
Yes.
It sounds like a nutty idea to me.
This is the Sam I know. Right. Okay, we'll move on now. Will President Obama support the growth of nuclear power? And if not, why?
I have no idea. He seems to have meetings with Harry Reid, and then Harry Reid speaks for the president. I have never heard the president make any comments about nuclear power, except that, you know, he is apparently, according to Senator Reid, he is apparently against Yucca Mountain. But even I've not heard him say that. I've just heard Senator Reid say that. So I simply don't know. I think it's a mistake, as I have said before, and I think his choice of communication levels are questionable.
You're doing pretty well, young man. All right.
I've had experience.
I understand that France reprocesses its spent nuclear fuel. Isn't it possible politically that the U.S. could also do this instead of burying it in Yucca Mountain?
Sure. I mean, we can do that. The problem is, I mean, that's the plan, which would incorporate a reprocessing of nuclear fuel. I mean, that's what the ultimate issue is. Shouldn't we reprocess nuclear fuel? And you see, I guess 20 years ago or some such time, we made the decision to not reprocess. So we've done no work on reprocessing nuclear fuel in over 20 years, maybe 30. We mistakenly thought that if we, America, who invented the stuff, invented the idea of using uranium for power production, that if we refused to reprocess, that nobody else would do it either. People forgot to tell France and Russia and China that they weren't supposed to. So they did. So we're well behind the eight ball in terms of nuclear power. And so that's what GNEP is all about, and we're trying to work our way back into it. But we ran out of time, and we did what we did. We applied for the Yucca Mountain application. The idea was that it would then have a four-year or five-year time frame from the time of the application, which was late in 08. So it would be 2012, and we hope that the political situation changes by that time.
Okay. Is there a way to reconcile the stated desire of Iran to produce nuclear power for peaceful purposes with the possibility that Iran might subvert that position to military use?
No.
Amplify.
Well, I think it's an issue of that the Iranians, nobody trusts Iran to follow through on whatever pledges they make, and the fact that they're testing, that they've run tests on missiles and so on. I mean, it is clear they intend to attack Israel, and that's part of the drill. So I think that's why we need to stop them if it's possible.
Okay. Will the U.S. ever be serious about offshore oil drilling, such as places like Anwar, or do we need a return to the $100 a barrel oil?
Well, I think we're going to get the $100 barrel oil anyway. That's my own view. As soon as the American economy gets geared up again and recovers, that's what determines oil prices, is what happens in this country. And so I don't think that apparently there is such a if you think about it, the we have a group of Democratic senators who view it as a right, as a privilege that they carry with them. None of the senators are from the affected area. Those are, they tend to be people who are more inclined to drill offshore. And it's the people in New England. It's the, and my old home state in particular. And it's, I think it's completely foolish, and I think that there is a time now, better than a time later, to drill in Anwar, but I am of the distinct minority in Washington.
Okay, this comes from our students again. What changes should the younger generation make today to make a big impact later in life in regards to energy use?
I just talked about it. More energy efficiency, in my judgment, nuclear power. This work on biofuels, which I believe is the key. I mean, if you can make, grow plant goods that are non-food based and convert those into gasoline, not ethanol, but real gasoline, that is the key, I think, and that needs to continue. And apparently it will continue under Mr. Obama, and that's one of the good things that he's doing. And so I think that's a plus. But and as well as clean coal technologies, we need everything. All means of generating energy, and then let the market make a judgment, make a determination as to what makes the most sense. So I am hopeful that that will be the case.
Thank you. How are we, the free world, ever going to get China to cooperate seriously in reducing emissions?
We simply have to. If all of the OECD countries, which include the United States, Japan, most of Western Europe, those are the OECD countries. If we reduced our emissions to zero, we would still, due to the efforts of China, India, Brazil, all of the developing world, that's where the increase is going to come from, all of it. And we have got to find a way to deal with the Chinese, and that they need to understand that. And I think we're going to have to be more forthcoming and more aggressive than we have been in the past. I think that's a fair statement. But it's also true that it doesn't make any sense to work on this without China, in particular China and India's cooperation.
Having said that, will a carbon tax push America's heavy industry over into India and China?
Yes.
This is one you know a lot about, Sam, not that you didn't before, but what is the place and future of liquid natural gas as a clean and low-cost form of natural gas?
Well, Dick mentioned that Cabot ran a natural gas facility, so during my days there, during most of my days there, we eventually ended up selling the terminal to someone else, but it was a terminal for liquefied natural gas. I think it's the future of the industry is quite strong, and we have to find ways to generate more interest. And the only way to do that is to have the producers of the LNG have an interest in the terminal. And that's been the case with Qatar, which has got an interest in their terminal, in the terminal down in Texas. I think it's important that that we continue to work at that. It's, again, we need everything. Natural gas, coal, nuclear power, renewable energy, we need it all. If we're to deal with this. This is an issue that the younger generation in particular will have to worry about. And I hope that a number of these students will be studying science and math and chemistry in college. We need more, and it's important that we generate it.
Well, then, should the U.S. have a gasoline or energy tax in order to promote conservation?
There's a thing, if you want, there's a statement in government, if you want less of something, you tax it. And so if you want less gasoline, you tax it. And so that one can make a case for that. I think it's fair to say there is a case to be made for that. The other side is that it's a very divisive issue. If you live in downtown New York City drive around and where you don't need to drive a great deal, it's one thing. But if you live in the West and you have to drive from Cheyenne to wherever, it gets to be a continuing problem. So I do think there is room for an increase in taxes, but I certainly don't think that's going to be the ultimate solution.
Okay, we have time for just two more. The next one is from a student. I was wondering as to your stance on President Obama's recent announcement on the high-speed train that is set to run through certain sectors, including Florida, from South Florida to Orlando.
That's good. Anything that increases transportation and is looked to as a way of reducing energy use, I'm all for. It's much better. I can't tell you how many. My wife and I recently drove from North Palm Beach, where we have an apartment, back to Washington, and I can't tell you how many people were on the road with just one person, one driver in the car. I mean, it's crazy. And they were from all parts of the world. And so anything that increases energy efficiency is to be encouraged.
Okay, now, we've just heard the Secretary on all sorts of really important global issues. The last question is saved for one that is really important to those of us that are going through this recession right here in Naples. Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, shows Naples being flooded in the future. Should I sell my Gulf Shore Boulevard second floor condo and buy one on the seventh floor?
I wouldn't want to comment on Mr. Gore's technical skills. But I think that there is, it's fair to say, I do think that there is some reason to believe that one ought to be concerned about it and ought to be concerned about rising water levels and so on. I do think that that's an issue. I wouldn't want to buy a unit on the seventh floor. Maybe I should just let it go with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Remember, please hang around for just a minute. We're going to have the ceremonial season-end passing of the gavel to our new president, as of May 1st, Wade Keller. Please welcome him.
Thank you, Alan. I wanted to take just a moment to make a few comments. In the almost 25-year history of the Forum Club, we've had some good presidents and we've had some so-so presidents. When I think about Alan, I think about last year when he chaired the program committee, and the results of that chairing of the program committee is the 12 outstanding speakers that we had here this year. And that was an outstanding job. And I can personally tell you that chairing the program committee is not always an easy job. And then this year, Alan chaired the board of directors, another independent-minded group. Alan has that rare ability to know when to push an issue and when to sort of back off and hope that a consensus will develop later. And in both of those cases, both the program committee and the board of directors, I've been very fortunate to have Alan as a role model and a mentor. In those two, I'm sort of hard-headed sometimes, sort of slow to learn. So it's been especially important for me to have a really good role model like Alan. So Alan, I just want to salute you. I say thank you. I say that your year as president has left this club stronger than it was before. And members of the Forum Club, would you please join me in giving Alan a round of applause? Now, Now, let me make two quick comments about the year ahead, and then we'll get out of here. This is our 25th anniversary, and as a consequence, we're going to have a celebration. The date has been set for January the 22nd. We think that's going to hold. It's going to be an evening. We're going to have entertainment, and we're going to have a real blowout celebration of our 25th anniversary. One other thing I want to make a quick comment about is that the program committee has done another outstanding job this year, and we've got some exciting programs coming up. I'm going to only mention two. On November the 13th will be our first meeting of the new year, and thanks to Joe Fogg, we have Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina talking about the future of the Republican Party, hopefully. And also in December, thanks to Mary Ann Ramsey, also on the program committee, we will have Mr. Will Whitehorn, who is the president of Virgin Galactic. So Richard Branson is getting into the space business, and we will have an opportunity to go into for individuals to be going into space. This is going to be a very exciting program in December. I won't go over the rest of them. We're ready to go. Have a great summer. We stand adjourned.